I think we're up against a few things. As far as the state is concerned, there is an array of laws that doesn't really allow us to have open discussions or deliberations on Islam. I mean, first of all, Islam is used as a source of public policy and legislation. You know, we have quite a comprehensive array of Sharia laws on both personal matters and Islamic criminal matters. But at the same time, it's difficult to discuss different alternatives to these laws because I think embedded in these laws, for example, in the Sharia laws, it is actually a crime to question a fatwa that has been issued by a state-appointed mufti in Malaysia. You know, and I think this is quite unheard of in the Muslim world because in the Muslim world, the fatwa has moral sanction, but it doesn't have legal sanction in this way. So in Malaysia, you have this situation where there are laws legislated in the name of Islam. You have fatwas being issued which carry the force of law, and then suddenly it becomes illegal for you to question the fatwa, you know, and there are censorship laws where certain books, certain publications on Islam are banned. You know, for a long time, quite a few titles by Karen Armstrong were banned in Malaysia. You know, for example, I think the History of God, A History of God was banned in Malaysia at some point. And in addition to that, I think there's also the sort of more community-based fear, you know, the non-state actors are scared of open debate and discussion as well, you know, where any idea that even smells of liberal Islam is just dismissed, it's not discussed, you know, you're not allowed to discuss it. If you do try to discuss it, you might find that you have a police report lodged against you by some Islamist pressure group that doesn't like what you've just said. So, yeah, on a few levels, that silencing of debate happens in Malaysia.
And what ultimately lies down that road after the police report? What happens there? Are there stiff penalties for this kind of thing?
I think, you see, the laws have been there. Some of them are quite archaic. They exist in our penal code, and we inherited, you know, the penal code from the British. So the laws have been there. I don't think they've been tested till now, so I don't really know what the courts could decide. I mean, you know, the ultimate worst-case scenario is that you could be labeled a threat to national security, and therefore you could be detained under the Internal Security Act, which is sort of like the Patriot Act, you know. I think it's a bit worse, though, because it's really detention without trial, you know. So that's the ultimate worst-case scenario.
And yet, critical voices aren't completely silenced. For example, we have an NGO like Sisters in Islam, a high-profile group promoting the rights of women in Islam. What is a group like this able to achieve? What have they achieved?
I think what Sisters in Islam manages to do because of the legal and intellectual expertise within the group is, you know, for example, the legal clinic really manages to help a lot of women who face injustice within the Sharia system, you know, and it helps them by arguing for a more just and humane interpretation of Islam within the Sharia framework. So in that sense, it offers very, very good and sound legal service to Muslim women in need. And it also manages to push the discourse in some ways, you know, by introducing ideas that people might not be aware of in this environment where debate is so regulated and restricted, you know. But at the same time, I think it would be a mistake to think that the state is happy with the existence of Sisters in Islam. You know, it is a very vulnerable organization. You know, it is threatened left, right, and center. You know, whether from the opposition Islamist party PAS, or whether it's from the ruling party UMNO, or whether it's from Islamist pressure groups or Islamist academics. You know, I mean, Sisters in Islam gets a lot of flack from all quarters.
But what protects them? Because so far it is only flack, isn't it? They haven't been hauled up before the courts, as far as I'm aware.
No, they've got lawsuits against them. You know,
okay.
There's a lawsuit against them now to drop the word Islam from the name of their organization, because the accusation from this certain Islamist group is that there is nothing Islamic about Sisters in Islam. You know, so there is it's a case that could go to court. You know, there are a couple of police reports against Sisters in Islam, which are still under investigation. You know, the office has been broken into before. just as Sisters in Islam was campaigning on some particularly, you know, controversial issues. So there is a real threat against Sisters in Islam. I think the thing that allows Sisters in Islam to continue to exist is that it has a very respected overseas profile. You know, I think even a lot of Muslims overseas like the kind of work that Sisters in Islam does, and they cannot understand the hostility towards Sisters in Islam from within Malaysia. And I think the Malaysian government knows that if anything really bad were to happen to Sisters in Islam, that would really damage Malaysia's reputation overseas. So I think that's probably the main thing working in Sisters in Islam's favor right now.
If we go back a few years to 2004, the former Prime Minister Abdullah Badawi, in his election campaign that year, he made a big thing of promoting Islam Hadari, which is often translated as progressive Islam, and it was promoted as an open-minded, tolerant brand of the faith concerned with protecting the rights of women and minorities and safeguarding the environment and so on. It was hugely popular with the electorate. Abdullah won that election by a landslide, and the media proclaimed a new era of progressive Islam in Malaysia. And that was 2004. What happened?
I think it was a combination of weak and miscalculated leadership by Abdullah as a prime minister. And part of it, I think, was a serious miscalculation of the entrenchment of a certain kind of Islamist politics within the civil service. You know, because you can have a new government that says, you know, it wants to embark on this paradigm shift. But if you have the civil service, which is largely composed of Malaysian Muslims, you know, Malay Malaysians who are Muslims, who are resistant to that idea, I think it's quite difficult for it to gain traction. And I think it was subverted quite a bit by the Islamic bureaucracy in Malaysia as well, who on the surface, I think they paid lip service to it, but carried on with the same old, you know, there was still a lot of repressive actions carried out by the state, even despite this rhetoric of Islam Hadari. I think it's more accurately translated as civilizational Islam, not progressive Islam. So, yeah, I mean, to me, that's what it appeared to be, you know, this resistance on the ground, because I think as a prime minister, he was intellectually enlightened, I think. I think he is an intellectually enlightened individual. I just don't think he had the political will to translate that vision into a political and social reality.
And yet the great popularity of an idea like Islam Hadari would indicate a deep gulf between what Malaysian Muslims want to believe and practice and then the kind of politicized authoritarian Islam fostered by the government and civil service. Do you see it that way?
I think it's not really that black and white. There is actually a lot of confusion. I think if you ask a lot of young Malaysians, especially now, I think in theory they would support a more aggressive kind of Islam or Islamic administration in Malaysia. You know, but I don't think there is this understanding of what that would really entail. You know, because in Malaysia we don't really hear bad news from countries like Iran or Saudi Arabia. You know, what the religious authorities, the kind of damage they could really do to the ordinary citizen. You know, in the interest of protecting the image of Islam, we are not exposed to these images. You know, so I think a lot of people think, no, well, why not? This is an alternative to Western globalization. This is an alternative to Western hegemony. You know, why not try an Islamic system without actually being able to interrogate how this system could really go wrong? You know, so there is not that kind of debate happening just yet, you know, and it doesn't help that whenever you try to even open the debate a little bit, people then label you, I don't know, a liberal Muslim or, you know, a feminist, like it's a really bad thing to be a feminist and a Muslim. So then you get labeled, you get dismissed, and, you know, your argument never sees the light of day. So it's really more complicated than that, I think.
Why do you think it is that when you have a situation where Islam becomes highly politicized and is used as a source of public power and legitimization, why do you think this results in a narrow conservative form of Islam rather than a more flexible pluralist form of Islam? Because in some ways you'd think it could go either way.
I know that's a really interesting question. I really don't know the answer to that, because if I look at a country like Indonesia, which is, you know, the most populous Muslim country in the world, in terms of Islamic tradition and culture, it is very similar to Malaysia. And in terms of government regulation, yes, there is a sort of government regulation of Islam there. You know, there are publicly funded Islamic universities. You know, the government would fund postgraduate studies for Islamic scholars and ulama in Indonesia so that they came back with a more rounded view of the world. And, you know, we think that Indonesia is this country where there were the Bali bombings, but a lot of very cutting-edge progressive scholarship on Islam also comes out of Indonesia. And I really have no idea why that has happened there and why it does not happen in Malaysia.
There was a group of Malaysian academics recently, I read, they warned of what they called the Talibanization of Malay society, and they placed the blame for this on Malaysia's education system and intellectual culture. Do you share that concern about what's being taught in the schools and universities there?
Absolutely. I'm a product of the Malaysian public school system, you know, from primary to secondary school. And the kind of things that I was taught in my, you know, Islamic religious classes, you know, I found out a lot of other things to do with Islam when I got out of school. You know, I was exposed to a lot of other literature on Islam that I would never have been allowed to touch in school. So, you know, in school we learn things like, you know, the punishment for homosexuality is death. The punishment if a Muslim renounces Islam and embraces another religion, it is also death. You know, that's the kind of stuff you are taught in school. But when you read just the diverse amount of Islamic literature there is, whether it's contemporary or classical, there's actually a lot more diversity of opinion out there. And this diversity of opinion is never even hinted at in school or even in the quote-unquote intellectual culture in Malaysia right now. Islam is seen as monolithic. That's a very hegemonic, uniform kind of idea of what Islam is, when actually it's more diverse than that.
Mm. That's being pushed against, though, isn't it? I read an interview that you did recently with a representative of the Islamic Renaissance Front, and this is a group who's, you know, bidding to reinvigorate intellectual dynamism in Malaysian Islam. From what you're saying, it sounds like they have an uphill task, but do you hold out hopes for these kinds of groups?
Yes, I really do hold out hope from these kinds of groups, because the founder of the Islamic Renaissance Front, Dr. Amir Farouk Musa, is a former Islamist, you know. I think he still identifies as an Islamist in a lot of ways. He is just much more open to an open debate, critical discussion now, you know. But I think he does come from that background where he thought Islam was about this. You know, there was always this black and white, what is Islamic, what is not Islamic. I think he does come from that background, but he's shifted. And I think a lot of these people shift when they start to actually confront the Islamic texts themselves, you know, the Quran, the Hadith, all the commentaries that have been written by Islamic jurists and scholars throughout the centuries. And then they realize that, wow, there is actually a lot of diversity of opinion in Islam. You know, I mean, I interviewed another imam from New York, Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, and I asked him, you know, what is the position of, you know, Islamic jurisprudence on lesbian, gay, bisexual and transsexual issues? Is it as cut and dried as we're told? And he said, look, even in, you know, the classical commentaries of Islam, people grappled with, say, the inheritance rights of people of, you know, at that time, what they called indeterminate gender, people whose gender could not be determined. You know, they had to try and figure out how to still honor these people's inheritance rights, which shows you that it wasn't a punitive kind of discourse. It was still about thinking, well, these people don't conform to gender norms, but how can we still respect their inheritance rights? You know, and this is within the corpus of Islamic jurisprudence. And I think the more Islamists confront these texts honestly and look at the diversity of the debate, I think they will come to the conclusion that, well, actually it's not such a crime to accept different opinions in Islam.
When you talk about these earlier sources, then it puts me in mind of what some Muslims say, that Islam doesn't need to be modernized, it doesn't need to be westernized to be progressive. And then if you go back a few centuries, if you go back to the right sources, you find a time when Muslim communities were highly egalitarian and women held positions of power and authority and Muslim rulers welcomed Christians and Jews and so on. What do you make of that argument?
I think on some level there is some merit to that argument, but I worry about arguments like this because I wonder what kind of past are we appealing to? Because that's the best of what fascism does as well. It appeals to a kind of mythologized, idealized past where everything was okay. Even in the earliest days of the Islamic civilization, not everything was okay. Two of the caliphs who succeeded Prophet Muhammad's political leadership were violently assassinated by Muslims, you know? So this shows you that all was not well in the Muslim world, even in those early days. But at the same time, I agree, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in these early sources of Islamic jurisprudence and theology that we can tap into, you know. A lot of these misogynistic ideas in Islam right now, I don't think they exist in these classical commentaries. I mean, sure, there is a kind of value system that privileges male dominance, but not to the extent that we see in some Islamic societies now. So to some extent, I think that debate has merit. But I think more important than anything else, we have to be honest and admit that not everything was right, even in the earliest days of Islam. And we have to find ways to move forward, you know, because we are reading these classical texts with contemporary eyes. It is impossible to reproduce those conditions because they happened 14 or 15 centuries ago. So, yeah, I think I would acknowledge that argument, but I take it with a pinch of salt as well.
If you look at Christianity and progressive Christianity, which we're talking about on this program, as well as Islam, there is an argument that says that once the dominoes of religious authority start to fall, once you start questioning biblical authority and questioning the doctrine of the incarnation, and once you start saying, well, maybe Jesus wasn't the Son of God after all, you arrive at a position which you can call, and which people do call, progressive Christianity. But for many people, it's a stop along the road to the point where you're no longer a Christian. And this is something that concerns more conservative Christians. And I wonder if you've mentioned to me in a previous conversation that you describe yourself as a doctrinally conservative Muslim. Do you have concerns yourself that if you start pushing at the sources, pushing at this authority, that somewhere along the line you get to a point where Islam is emptied of its, or emptying of its religious significance, and there's a problem there?
I realize now that I actually have two different ways of thinking about this. One is as a citizen of a state that is less than democratic, you know? I mean, I don't think the Malaysian state is fully democratized just yet. So from that lens, I think that it is important to uphold anyone's freedom of belief, anyone's freedom of expression, and anyone's freedom of information, you know? So if anyone wanted to embark on this religious quest in this way, I would say, well, you know, whatever floats your boat, I might not agree with it as a Muslim, but it's really up to you to do it, you know. And but on a personal level, as a Muslim, yeah, sure, I do get confronted by ideas like this sometimes. Like, I still don't know what to think of the idea of a woman leading mixed gender Friday prayers in Islam. On one hand, I feel that, well, you know, if you want to do it, then you do it. You know, but on the other hand, I understand also the fear and the anxieties that a lot of Muslims have about something like that. It's like thinking of a woman pope in Catholicism almost, you know. So I am a bit, not to say ambivalent, I'm still undecided about something like this, because I suppose in my context as a Malaysian, the thing that I'm struggling more against is this intensive an authoritarian state regulation of religious freedom. So I am thinking more in terms of what it means to be a citizen of a democratic country. As a citizen of a democratic country, I would definitely have to support, you know, even the rights of someone I vehemently disagreed with. But as a Muslim, I really don't know, you know. I mean, as long as someone can tell me why a particular development is Islamic, if they can justify to me what are the textual groundings, what are the religious traditions they are falling back on, I'm actually pretty willing to accept a lot of things, you know, even conservative positions on Islam. I'm not really, you know, I don't feel like silencing conservatives because I feel like they are legitimate stakeholders in society and they do have legitimate fears and anxieties sometimes, you know. But yeah, I suppose I'm still a bit undecided about that.
That really interests me because it sounds as though in that indecision you embody a tension between Islam and democracy that some people would say doesn't exist. Some Muslims, you know, defend Islam, saying that no, Islam is in no way incompatible with democracy. But there is a tension there, and it sounds like you very much sort of take that on yourself.
Yeah, I think I do, because ever since September 11, 2001, I have felt a heightened consciousness as a Muslim, whether I operate in Malaysia, which is a Muslim majority country, or whether I travel to Muslim minority contexts where I have to think about, well, what will people think of me if I tell them I need to observe my five daily prayers, or that I don't drink alcohol, or that I need to fast during Ramadan? Will they see me as a conservative? But they don't really know me, because politically I am so progressive, I am nearly off the chart, you know? Like, I would gladly defend LGBT Muslims or non-Muslims or whatever, you know, the rights of gay and lesbian Muslims or non-Muslims. I really don't see an incompatibility with that and being a Muslim.
And that's a political position, not a religious position for you.
It might be a bit of both, actually, because even as a Muslim in my faith system, I don't see anything in the religion that compels me to be homophobic. You know, I think all these arguments for homophobia in the name of Islam, I think they're quite dishonest. You know, I don't think they take into account the realities, the social realities of 7th century Arabia, during which the Quran was revealed. So to me, you know, it's a bit of a red herring when people say, oh, in Islam you can't be gay. You know, I'm thinking, well, who said that? I don't see any justification for that. So it's a bit of both, actually. But it's hard, because at the same time, then I do observe all these other things about being a Muslim, you know. I'm very careful to eat halal food to the best of my ability, you know. I'm very careful to go to the mosque on Fridays because I want to.